If something sounds too good to be true, it probably is. We offer that chestnut as a warning before you hear commentator Frank DeFord's thoughts this week about the National Football League and East Coast versus West Coast matchups. Okay, you've been warned, and that warning now complete. Frank DeFord has a tip for you should you feel compelled to do any betting on sports in the coming weeks.
Are you a gambler? Do you like to bet football? Then this is your lucky day. For if you just stay tuned, I'm going to offer you a free money-back guarantee on how you too can pick an NFL winner. Just don't turn that dial and listen to this important message. You know, folks, it ain't easy betting the NFL. Just look at any newspaper where so-called insiders pick games against the spread. Very few of these experts are even right half the time. No, to win betting against the spread, you need a real edge, like sleep. As I said, stay tuned. The point spread was created by a former math teacher named Charles K. McNeil, who opened a bookmaking operation in the 1940s, offering what he called wholesaling odds. Instead of taking bets on a team to win as you would a horse in a race, getting 6-1 or 7-2, whatever, McNeil, in effect, borrowed the handicap from golf, giving so many imaginary points to the underdog so the gambler could eschew complicated odds and make an even bet on any game. In the vernacular, taking the points or giving them. Okay, stay awake. In his book about sleep, Dreamland, the author David Randall reports on a football study at Stanford. Now, what we know is that typically human energy flags during the day, but for some primordial reason, picks up again around 6 o'clock. By 10, though, the Sandman has started his siren song. Now, a few times each NFL season, an Eastern team plays a Western team in a night game. For television reasons, all the games start around 8:30 Eastern time. That means for an East Coast home game, the West Coast players still have their body clock set at 5:30, ready to perk up, as the Eastern boys will soon run down. If the West Coast team is home, same thing. It's 5:30 for the Pacific boys, but the Atlantic guys' body clocks are 8:30. Follow me? It doesn't matter where the game is played, the West Coast bodies are coming to life as the East Coast bodies are feeling nature's circadian cues to sleep. And guess what the researchers found? Over a quarter century span, the West Coast teams beat the East an amazing 70% of the time against the spread. Hello, 70%. Okay, write this down and call your bookie. This Sunday night, Detroit plays at San Francisco. On December 16th, the 49ers play at New England. On December 23rd, San Diego plays the Jets in New Jersey. Hey, I'm giving you people winners. So Sunday, take San Francisco and give 6.5 points. And then stay awake and cash in. You're welcome.
The comments of Frank DeFord. He comes to us from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. The story told at Dixon Mounds Museum in Fulton County, Illinois, ends in 1673 when the French first arrived in West Central Illinois. But new exhibits are planned to explore the relationship between Native Americans and the early settlers from Europe. There's also a new presentation of the ancient burial remains that once made the museum controversial. Illinois Public Radio's Rich Egger has this report.
The exhibits will be installed as they're ready, and the museum could look much different by this time next year. Museum Director Michael Wyant says the new exhibits will cover around 160 years. They'll conclude with the Black Hawk War, which led to the end of natives holding land in Illinois. Wyant says no current exhibits will be replaced to make way for the new.
We like the way we tell the story so far, so we're going to leave that in place. It turns out that much of the work that was done here when the museum was renovated in the early 90s really focused on the floor and away from the walls. That means that the walls effectively are now a bare canvas that we have to work with. So there are ways that we're going to integrate this broader story into the perimeter of the exhibit. So things will stay the same, but they'll also be quite different.
What are some of the things visitors will see with these new exhibits?
Well, one thing I think will surprise them are the maps of the land treaties. It turns out that the ground we're on right now, on this west side of the Illinois River, from Calhoun County at the confluence of the Illinois and the Mississippi, all the way to Rock Island, was ceded to the United States in a single treaty, negotiated under some duress in St. Louis, and eventually would become what's known as the Military Tract, land given to veterans of the War of 1812. So we're going to produce those treaty maps and some of the text of treaties, and using contemporary technology, we can use things like QR codes so that people with smartphones and other applications, if they want to dig deeper into it, they could go right to the treaty language and read it if they wanted to while they were standing there looking at the maps.
Are there any other things from the new exhibits that you would like to highlight?
One thing we're going to do, for many years we've been asked a question about the burial exhibit. There are many people who still recall it. It still remains a difficult issue, supporters, detractors, and so on. But clearly there's curiosity. What we have done is digitized. We've created an electronic version of what the burial exhibit was like. And in using it as a backdrop, we can tell the story about what anthropologists have learned about the past here. This becomes important because while we can look at animal remains and plant remains, we can look at spearheads and pieces of pottery, it turns out that human beings tell us a story that we can't gain otherwise. So we're going to use this three-dimensional digital exhibit as a backdrop, and it will be a backdrop to telling the story about what these people told us about the past.
What do you mean by a three-dimensional digital exhibit?
So imagine a flat panel monitor, and when you turn it on, the image that you see is in 3D, and it is a rendering of the exhibit that you would have seen here if you'd traveled to this museum anytime between 1927 and 1991. And because it's digital, it allows us to maneuver ourselves around in it. So in a sense, you can look more closely at a particular individual or move away, look at the overview of them. It also gives us the kind of technology, for example, that it may be a touch screen kind of application, where if you touched the remains of a person, it would give them voice, if you will, and that voice could be a narration, an autobiographical narration about, this is what my life was like. I lived so long. I had some events in my life that had to do with my health and well-being and so on. So we think the time is right to relate to people the extraordinary amount of information that we gathered from the site that was here at Dixon Mounds.
There won't be any actual remains on display.
No remains on display. No remains, no photographs of remains, no real drawings of remains. In fact, the way the exhibit is created is we used a generic digital skeleton and essentially pieced it together anatomically so that it is a representation, but it doesn't use any of the materials that are controversial. So we want to be respectful in the way we educate, but we think that there is educational material there, and we're hoping an exhibit like this will be a common ground. So we're informed about the past, but we use a means by which people won't find offensive.
Dr. Michael Wyant is director of Dixon Mounds Museum. He says the museum provides remarkable insight into a profound time in human history, a time when people made the transition to corn agriculture. Wyant says in addition to new exhibits, new research is underway at Dixon Mounds. We'll talk about that tomorrow. Rich Egger reporting.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 12th of September, 2012. It was on this day in 1940 the cave paintings were discovered in Lascaux, France, by four French teenagers and their dog. They were out exploring one day, and they found the main cave, about 66 feet wide, 16 feet high, with drawings on the walls in charcoal that has been found to be about 17,000 years old, about 2,000 drawings, mostly of horses, bison, red deer, stags, some cats, extinct cattle, some human figures, geometric shapes, and the outlines of human hands, possibly the signatures of the artists. And there also appears to be a star chart, clusters of stars that resemble Taurus and the Pleiades. It's the birthday of Irénée Joliot-Curie, born in Paris, 1897. She was the daughter of Pierre and Marie Curie, homeschooled as part of an educational experiment run by her parents and their friends called the Cooperative. The adults, scientists, experts taking turns teaching one another's children. During World War I, she helped her mother operate mobile X-ray units in field hospitals. Her mother, Marie, who discovered radium. She began assisting her mother in the radium laboratory at the University of Paris, met a young chemical engineer named Frédéric Joliot. In 1935, the two of them won the Nobel Prize in chemistry for artificially creating radioactive elements. And then, like her mother, Irénée Joliot-Curie developed leukemia as a result of her close work with radioactive substances and died at the age of 58. And it was on this date in 1846, Elizabeth Barrett and Robert Browning eloped. They'd been courting in secret for a year and a half through the mail, unbeknownst to her father. It all began when Robert Browning wrote Miss Barrett a fan letter saying, "I love your verses with all my heart, and I love you too." And she wrote back to him. She was an invalid. She was a heavy user of morphine. Her father did not approve of Browning. They were married on this date in 1846. She went back home afterward, stayed for 1 week, then ran off to Italy with Browning and never saw her father again. Here's a poem for today by Mary Oliver, The Swan. Across the wide waters something comes floating, a slim and delicate ship filled with white flowers, and it moves on its miraculous muscles as though time didn't exist, as though bringing such gifts to the dry shore was a happiness almost beyond bearing. And now it turns its dark eyes, it rearranges the clouds of its wings, it trails an elaborate webbed foot the color of charcoal. Soon it will be here. Oh, what shall I do when that poppy-colored beak rests in my hand? Said Mrs. Blake of the poet, "I miss my husband's company. He is so often in paradise." Of course, the path to heaven doesn't lie down in flat miles. It's in the imagination.